Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved one company's plans to sell at-home genetic tests that reveal risks of certain diseases or conditions. The decision by the FDA is an about-face of a sort. It imposed a moratorium on the same company, 23andMe, in 2013. Some say this move could open the floodgates for personalized medicine. Others are concerned about the prospect of genetic selection at birth, not just for health reasons. Coming up, a Central Ohio native shares her story about a deadly genetic mutation that runs in her family and remains a ticking time bomb in her. Charles Piller covers the issues involved and recently wrote about the 23andMe decision for the health and medicine publication Stat, where he is the West Coast editor. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Charles Piller.
Thank you very much.
Why is the FDA's decision to permit 23andMe to sell the test for medical genetic testing a big deal?
Well, this is very important because it establishes a process for letting companies market directly to consumers, and that has been generally prohibited up till now. And it means that people will be able to make their own decisions about what genetically linked illnesses to learn about. It's not a home test, so you have to provide a sample, actually, of your saliva to 23andMe. You do it through a mail process, put it in a little container and mail it off to them. And it's important because it'll likely pave the way for many companies to get into what they are certain to see as a lucrative market. What it does not change is the standards for laboratory practices, which are separately regulated. So 23andMe's lab practices had long been certified as satisfactory, so that hasn't changed.
What was the sticking point then? If it wasn't the lab practices, what was the FDA concerned about?
Well, it's more than just being able to show that you can test adequately for a particular genetic trait. It also involved the FDA's insistence that 23andMe show that these tests were meaningful and that they presented information in an adequate way so that consumers could understand them on their own without the assistance necessarily of a doctor or a genetic counselor. The problem in this when 23andMe was originally banned is that they kind of went out like gangbusters, sort of a way that's popular in Silicon Valley to test the rules or even break the rules, saying that you're kind of reinventing an industry or reinventing the world, as it's popularly described in the Valley. And it's easier to get away with that if you're a company like Uber providing a ride service, but you can't really do it with biomedical testing, which is much more highly controlled and regulated for obvious safety reasons for consumers. And the company was forced to just sell ancestry data for a while and figure out how to convince the FDA that its tests were accurate, meaningful, and importantly, that consumers who received the results understood those results clearly.
Did 23andMe change something in how they how they share their information with consumers that convinced the FDA that it was ready to go ahead?
They did. And I should say that the FDA also did some rethinking. The FDA's position on this is that they want these tests to be available directly to consumers. They think it's an important bit of information that people should have access to. And they worked with the company to try to bring this to market. This involved an enormous amount of work to validate the accuracy and meaningfulness of the test. And the company also did a lot of surveys to show that the explanations that they provided to consumers were clear and understandable and to a wide range of consumers, not just sophisticated scientists who might be curious about their DNA, but to just about anybody. So in theory, FDA rethought its own process and established a method for being able to certify these as a good, well-established process. And it opens up the opportunity for other companies to similarly get their process certified with the agency. That's why people think it's going to open the floodgates. It will, in a sense. It's not going to be immediate. Every company that wants to jump into this has to separately go to the FDA and say, okay, here's how we're going to do it. here's why we think our process is adequate and equally good as 23andMe's process.
If I get a 23andMe genetic test, you know, I send the swab to the company, they, you know, put it through their laboratory tests, what am I going to learn? I guess, what's the universe of what I could learn?
Well, the company has long provided ancestry information, so you can learn some of the details of where you come from, where your family comes from, what kind of ethnic traits you might have in your family going back a long time. This change means that over time, it's not going to be instantaneously, but over time, you're also going to be able to learn about your possible genetic predisposition to having a number of genetically linked ailments. So these include late onset Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, the blood clotting disorder, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, and a disease called Gaucher's, which can cause a wide range of serious health problems. And then they'll also be rolling out over a little bit more time tests for other genetically linked ailments, including celiac disease, which is the sort of these days the famous predisposition towards having an inability to digest gluten. These are all things that will become something that consumers can just decide they want to know about and order the test on their own, which is different from today, where you have to go to a doctor and get that doctor to agree with you that it would be a good idea to have that test and to order it from a commercial lab through the doctor's office.
And so if it's done in that way, does insurance typically cover it?
Well, it depends on the circumstance.
Right.
But it often will be covered by insurance. But it's important to note also that 23andMe offers a wide range of testing, including the ancestry testing that I mentioned, mm-hmm. and tests for these genetically linked ailments for $200, which is a lot lower than you'd be paying to a commercial lab for the range of tests that are included in the 23andMe package. So I think each person's financial concerns associated with what they might be paying would have to be worked out depending on what their coverage is.
The tests don't tell you if you'll die of something or if you'll get something. It tells you if you have a predisposition for a genetic disorder like Parkinson's or some kinds of – or Alzheimer's or whatever it might be. How has the medical community responded to this new freedom, I suppose?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell.
Okay.
I would say that my guess is that doctors are going to be of two minds about this news. They'll be wary because they know that some patients inevitably will become confused or needlessly alarmed because they won't fully understand the results, no matter how careful 23andMe is at explaining the overall context. But they might also be encouraged because patients might come forward with information voluntarily and on their own initiative that can help diagnose or prepare for eventual illnesses. And as business people, of course, doctors know that more appointments mean more revenue. So I think they're going to like that too, just to be practical about it.
And then as far as privacy goes, are there any concerns about that? Because we know that if it can, there is a question about what this means going forward for insurability and that sort of thing.
Well, good question. There are two aspects to that. There are legal protections against discrimination based on genetic tests. They are complicated, so I won't explain all the details. I don't actually understand them fully myself. So, but in principle, you can't be discriminated against by insurance carriers or others for having for taking such tests. The other privacy question is a little bit more complicated as well. It has to do with the safety of your data that is then going to be held by a private company. I have no reason to believe that 23andMe is anything but extremely careful and vigilant about how their data security practices operate. And I know of no episodes where the company's data has been revealed without patient permission. That said, I think almost any thoughtful consumer knows that data security is a big problem in society, and you can hardly go by a week without hearing about another major data breach at a company that you thought knew better. This includes, at times, very unfortunately, medical data. So while there isn't any experience of that at 23andMe, I think a thoughtful consumer will be scrutinizing whatever company is offering these direct-to-consumer tests and also think clearly about the safety of their data as they go forward.
How accurate are the tests? Do we know?
Well, I think we can say safely that the tests are extremely accurate in the sense that they can tell you whether you have a genetic variant with a high degree of reliability. No test is, of course, foolproof. There are mistakes made. But I would say, in general, these are very reliable tests. And the labs, as I mentioned earlier, are certified by the government as having adequate lab practices. The issue really becomes, how do you interpret the information? What does it mean? And that's something that's a little bit harder to answer. None of the tests is 100% predictive. So even if you have a mutation, you might not get the disease. Even if it shows that you have a high likelihood of getting the disease, you might not get it. Most genetically linked conditions are also associated with environmental factors or unknown factors that scientists just haven't figured out, or they might be associated with a combination of genetic factors, some of which weren't even being tested for. So this simple result from a test is not always your destiny. That's very important to remember. Also, the indicators can vary by ethnicity, so it's important to get some degree of genetic counseling or talk to a well-informed physician before drawing too many firm conclusions about what the test results might mean for you personally.
Who gets to decide what genetic variances are looked for in testing like the 23andMe variety?
Well, this is part of the process that the company engaged in with FDA. And, you know, there's hundreds, thousands of scientists all over the world who are doing studies to try to link genetic characteristics, these so-called genetic variants, with certain diseases. And often it's a combination of genes that give you your predictive power. And these scientific studies are then reviewed by companies like 23andMe very carefully, and ultimately a decision is made about what the most likely variants are to look for. Then the company has to prove that they can correctly identify those variants in their lab tests and also counsel patients about their meaningfulness. So I would say that that process is very well established. It's just not known always how predictive the results are. And even when there is a lot of knowledge about the degree to which they are predictive, like, for example, if you have two certain variants for late-onset Alzheimer's, it's said that you could have up to 87% risk of contracting the disease during your lifetime compared to just 9% for the population as a whole. That's a pretty specific number. Mm-hmm. But it's important to remember that you always, even those numbers, you have to take with a grain of salt, and also look at other family characteristics and talk to your physician about it.
You have investigated as well dubious genetic testing by lab companies that work through doctors, and you've reported that the FDA reversed course last year by deciding not to regulate many genetic tests. What's going on there?
Well, I appreciate you asking that question because it's an important second side of this whole story. This is not the convention. The 23andMe model is brand new for direct-to-consumer marketing of these genetic tests. But, of course, there are hundreds of labs that already provide a wide range of genetic testing for consumers, and you have to get it through your doctor. I reported on one such company called Prove Biosciences in California, and this is a company that has jumped on the bandwagon of people's fears of the opioid epidemic to offer tests for what they call tendency to become addicted or dependent on opioids. Unfortunately, their tests are not nearly so well established scientifically as the ones that 23andMe is relying on. And there's very little evidence that these are an accurate and well-founded basis for predicting a person's tendency towards addiction. That's the first problem. And there are many such companies that are offering what I would deem a dubious or unscientifically founded tests for not just for opioid addiction, but for other problems as well. This company also has been implicated by its own former and current employees in providing test results, providing rewards to doctors for essentially funneling patients to them to take these tests. And I'm not describing these as kickbacks, although experts who have evaluated this have said that the characteristics of this company certainly would have the possibility of running afoul of kickback laws. And former employees and current employees worry that these are essentially unproven tests being sold in a bogus way through doctors' offices. So I think the important message for consumers of medical services is that just because you're getting something through your doctor's office doesn't necessarily mean that even that genetic test is well-founded, correct, and even in your own interest to get. It's important for consumers to do a bit of their own research and understand also the financial relationship between the doctor and the testing company.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved one company's plans to sell at-home genetic tests that reveal certain diseases or conditions. My guest, Charles Piller, covers those issues, and he recently wrote about the 23andMe decision for the Health and Medicine publication Stat, where he is West Coast editor. We'll post a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And Charles Piller, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Charles Piller, West Coast editor at Stat. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about genetic testing and its implications. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When Jocelyn Linder was in her teens, her physician father died of a mysterious illness that included swelling, bloating, and starvation. When she hit her 20s, her own ankles began to swell. Eventually, Linder's relatives came together with pieces of a puzzle of a family disease that spanned five generations and appeared unique to the family. Jocelyn Linder, who grew up in Columbus and now lives in New York City, details the discovery in a new book entitled The Family Gene, A Mission to Turn My Deadly Inheritance into a Hopeful Future. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jocelyn, first tell us how you became aware that you had a medical problem. What was the link between your dad's illness and what you soon learned about yourself?
Well, I think we knew. We kind of were expecting to have some symptoms as we grew up, my sister and I, because we had our gene had been studied over the course of about 15 years by the time we started to show symptoms. So we had an idea.
Of your dad's illness?
Because of our dad's illness, yeah. So when I was 16 was the first time my father started to show symptoms. I'm now 42. So, you know, that was the first time I ever knew there was maybe something going on in our family. And then at that point, we just thought there was something going on with him.
Right.
And then a few years later, we realized there was a genetic component. He brought in a genetics team to work with him to try to figure things out. But that was in like 1995, which is we're still looking at 8 years before the Human Genome Project was published. Right. And they just didn't know anything. So at the time my sister and I got sick, however, or started to show symptoms, we were aware we had the gene.
I was interested in and want to learn more or understand a little bit better how the geneticists from Harvard isolated the kind of the telltale to a heart murmur.
Well, there was a symptom that she just kept running into with people in the family, and that was this heart murmur. So she was a cardiogeneticist or a cardiologist who studied genetics.
At the time, yeah.
Yeah, and she still is. I mean, that's her bread and butter. She was one of the first people, I think the first to clone a heart, piece of heart tissue. And mm-hmm. so that was her thing. So I think she was very interested in that piece of the story. But that isn't obviously the main part of the story. It just was a little hint as to, you know, who might have this gene before they knew what the gene was.
But that started to create the patterns that eventually helped the family come together over this.
Exactly. Yep. It helped her to figure out maybe who had it and who didn't.
The genes has killed, I shouldn't say the gene, but anyways, the consequences of the mutated gene has killed 5 people in the Linder family, mm-hmm. And it now threatens you and your sister. Mm-hmm. What does it do? I mentioned very in stark brevity what happened to your dad, but what does it do?
Well, there were 14 people that have ever had this gene that we think is that we believe. And there were 2 of them, my grandmother and my great great grandmother, who we think is patient zero. Neither of them had very many symptoms. My grandmother had a lot of swelling and some of this lymphedema or pure lymph that settled in her belly. But the fact that women get it differently than men is actually a big piece of the puzzle that we use to solve it. But basically, so in men, over the course of about 3 years, the body just starts to leak this pure lymph, and it's protein rich. So if you're leaking protein, you're not digesting it. So over the course of these 3 years, these men became very weak, and obviously over time starved. That was their biggest problem with this leaking of the lymph.
You worked with Dr. Christine Seidman at Harvard University Medical School.
And Seidman, it's, yeah.
Oh, it's Seidman. Yeah. Sorry, I knew Seidman. So that's Seidman at Harvard University Medical School. How it was your dad that connected you?
Yeah, it was. Well, my dad's case, but I think that okay. There were a lot at that point. People were talking about it, and there are several people that said that they knew her that brought her to us. So she probably heard it from multiple sources.
And then you talked about your great great grandmother, who was the initial kind of ground zero for this. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of mystical to think about the fact that I think you wrote that she was just, they think, spontaneously, for some reason no one understands, born with it, and how rare it is that a disease like this only goes back 5 generations.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I think with figuring her out, we actually took photographs because my great grandmother, her daughter, died sort of slowly over 20 years, or you know, developed symptoms, and then in fact, when she died officially of an infection from an exploratory surgery. She didn't officially die of the starvation that the men did, but her mother, in photographs we saw, had these identical swollen legs, and the shape of the legs looked exactly the same, and it just seemed really plain, you know, very obvious to us that she must have had it as well. She didn't pass it to anybody else, and as far as we know, you know, we've been looking for many years now, we haven't found any families with a similar situation. So what that means is it's a 1 in a billion mutation. This is incredibly a very rare thing. It doesn't happen all the time, and you also have to consider, you know, so if it mutated in her, say in the 50% of her cells, you know, when she was four cells old, say 50% of her cells had this gene, she then only has, you know, a 25% chance of passing it to any. So a lot of these genes, if there are these spontaneous mutations, they might be weeded out naturally because there's so few of them to pass. But in her, you know, she did unluckily pass it to her daughter.
I want to now bring into the conversation the past president of the National Society of Genetic Counselors, Don Allain. Don is a licensed genetic counselor at Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Don, we were talking earlier about getting genetic tests and that, you know, no matter what, you should be, if there are any, you know, you should be going, if you have any concerns, talk to a genetic counselor. What does a genetic counselor do?
So genetic counselors work with families first by starting off just asking the types of questions that Jocelyn was mentioning, looking at the family history, who in the family has illnesses, how are they running through a family, and then walking families through the process of whether or not something looks like it's hereditary, and if there's genetic testing, whether or not that genetic testing might benefit the family and help them make medical management decisions down the road.
Would that help you when somebody like Jocelyn, without the knowledge that she now has, comes to you and says, can you look for what might be causing this for my family?
So we do see families that are seeking answers, much like Jocelyn. And so we may take family histories, and if there isn't a known genetic diagnosis that rises to the top, then we would connect them with researchers like Dr. Seidman and getting them involved in research to try to identify the underlying genetic causes. So that is part of the role of a genetic counselor.
And how rare is the occurrence of a genetic mutation like this being discovered?
That's a good question. You know, we all carry genes that predispose us for genetic conditions. It's a matter of determining whether or not there is a clinical phenotype or a clinical presentation that lets us know how to track it. I can't say with certainty how common it would be to find a mutation, but the fact that there are rare genetic diseases that are still being identified now lets us know that there's a lot we still don't know.
Right. How does So you said there's 14 people in the family over five generations that
Yes.
have been affected by this.
Yep.
Is that a lot?
No. You know, the traditional genetic counselor,
it
sounds like a lot. But most families, when we're looking at them, you'll see multiple generations affected. And we can go back five, six, seven generations and identify where the disease is in a family. When we see families in clinic, we always take at least a minimum three generation pedigree, because that's the smallest sort of pattern that we'll be able to identify something in, but they can get much larger than that.
And how was it just photographs, Jocelyn, or how did you go back and learn more? I mean, people don't really save their medical records necessarily.
Well, we were a little bit fortunate in that, because my great uncle, who died in 1961 at the age of 34 of a very identical presentation to my father, my aunt Joni had run around, you know, trying to get his charts together, and he had been in the National Institutes of Health for 10 months, and you know, luckily they were
very good about studying him.
They were studying him,
yeah.
And they had kept all of his chart material, and she brought it to us. And at the same time she was doing that, they had also collected some information from Nathan's mother. They didn't connect them as being, you know, related at that point, those diseases, but they thought maybe there was some similarities, so they had certain information about her as well. So we were kind of lucky in this way that chart came to us with information about two people with similar presentations. But I don't think that's probably very usual.
So does this mean that it passes through both genders, male and female, can pass this?
Yeah. Well, it's an X-linked condition.
Right.
Which means, you know, so we kind of know women have two X's. It's sort of a generally speaking, women have two X's and men have an X and a Y. So a woman has, you know, more X information to refer to in her body, and a man has just the one X. So if it's bad information, a lot of the time you just see the bad information.
Okay. But they both can pass it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in my father's case, he had two girls, and he has an X and a Y. Since we're girls, he passed us his X. If we'd been boys, he would have passed us his Y. So that was unlucky.
Gotcha. Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Don, for research purposes, this is interesting and edifying and important. What's the importance of knowing one's family's history of health in terms of genetics?
So with all the technology that we have to date to identify genetic diseases, family history is still the single most gold standard for us to do risk assessment. So being able to talk with your family members about the diseases in your family and track that is extremely important and can help us in medical management and personalizing that medical management for individuals. So it's really important to have that conversation with family.
And what's the difference between genetics and genomics?
Good question. So genetic testing is what we would refer to as the traditional genetic inheritance, so the X-linked inheritance that Jocelyn was talking about. When we start talking about genomics, we're looking at larger sections of the genome. So genetics, it's one gene, one disease. Genomics, we're looking at multiple genes to try to identify the underlying cause of something.
Jocelyn, how are you feeling now? What is it? What, how does this manifest at this point in your life? You said you're 42?
I'm 42, yeah. 42. Well, so our gene, we now know, thanks to the work that's been done on our case, that our gene is causing pressure complications in the portal vein of our liver. So I think it's kind of amazing. One of the things we've learned is that our livers actually have a heartbeat, which was sort of a question that I think is still being studied and it's not published yet. But I think that that's kind of where they're headed with that. So my sister and I have both had this breakdown of the portal vein in our liver, which causes internal sort of vascular aneurysms that are very delicate pathways that could burst internally and cause us problems. So far, we've stayed relatively healthy. We both feel pretty good. In my case, I have some swelling in my limbs from the lymphedema, but nothing, you know, that's not manageable. And so, you know, basically we're okay, but it's, you know, if you met us, you wouldn't have any idea.
So when you say that's manageable, do you manage it with drugs? Do you manage it with lifestyle? What?
My swelling?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wear like stockings that are like compression. That
like support
sort of,
hose type
yeah,
of thing?
And that
kind of
makes
a thing?
It more comfortable. I mean, it's, you know.
And what's happening is it's actually fluid that's gathering. And a typical day, it doesn't affect you?
I mean, not. No, I mean, it's just I mean, it's annoying. And I sometimes wish I could wear better shoes, but, you know, it's
the shoes thing.
Yeah, totally.
You wrote about that. That's when you first started to really notice it.
Right.
You kind of ignored it for a while.
Yeah, I mean,
tried
it was there. It was some swelling. You know, I think even if you saw me, you know, in a bathing suit, which I still go swimming. I still, you know, I don't always cover my legs, but, you know, you can tell it's swollen, but it's not. You know, I think it's probably not as bad as people might imagine. So it looks a little bit like heavier than the other leg.
But the long term prognosis, you've described yourself as like a ticking time bomb.
Yes, we've been told that that is a possibility, you know, that something could just burst and there could be a catastrophic consequence. So, you know, we're on high alert, but also we're hopeful that there's going to be answers soon.
That's why you wrote the book.
Yeah, sure. And I think that also just everything happening with genetic medicine, which is, you know, I think for many years, my great uncle, in his case, they treated by having him drink his fluid. In my father's case.
What?
Yeah. That was the treatment for lymphedema for anybody with lymphedema at that time. My father, in his case, they used a port to sort of put the nutrients directly back into his body and directly back into his veins. And so I'm hopeful that in our case, they'll have something even better. It's been, you know, 20 years now since he died, that there must be better solutions. And especially now that we know the origin of the mechanism that's causing the illness, I think that there is hope, and I think that they will figure things out.
And Dawn Elling, 100 years ago, that could have been Jocelyn's great-great-grandmother could have been the origin of a disease that could eventually affect thousands and hundreds of thousands of people over time because
right.
of the way we multiply.
Correct. You know, passing it on. In this case, it's an autosomal condition, so it's a she has a chance of passing it on to both males and females. And then as they get married, they have a risk of passing it on. So it will distribute throughout the population. And that, you know, that's one thing that happens with all genetic conditions. So you'll see even particular genetic diseases that have founder effects. So we can actually trace it all the way back to, you know, hundreds of generations ago of when it sort of first started and how it was then passed on just by populations expanding across, you know, continents.
We'll talk about this more. You just heard from Dawn Elling. She's a licensed genetic counselor at Ohio State University and also with us, Jocelyn Linder. She's a native Central Ohio and lives in New York City. Now she's the author of a new book entitled The Family Gene, A Mission to Turn My Deadly Inheritance into a Hopeful Future. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the growing field of genetic testing this hour, what we can learn from genetic testing, what we can't. Still with us is licensed genetic counselor at Ohio State University, Dawn Elaine. Welcome back. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And also the author of a new book entitled The Family Gene, A Mission to Turn My Deadly Inheritance into a Hopeful Future, Jocelyn Linder. Thanks again, Jocelyn, for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Federal Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, was passed to help protect people against genetic discrimination. What do we mean by genetic discrimination, Dawn Elaine?
So what GINA does is it protects individuals from having their health insurance companies utilize their genetic testing to either increase their individual premiums, increase the amount that they or a group health plan might have to contribute. So the idea is not to use information that we all have, that we're all at risk for, against us in getting coverage.
Was that an issue for you, Jocelyn Linder, you know, I guess before the Affordable Care Act and that sort of thing?
When I was right out of college, both my sister and I ran into problems getting health insurance. We were both very healthy. There was nothing wrong, but we had this functional heart murmur that was brought up earlier, and a doctor reported that to the state of Ohio, and Ohio had pretty strict pre-existing condition laws, and they were just like, sorry. And it was really weird because we'd never been sick. If you looked at our medical history, we'd never, you know, I think I had appendicitis when I was in
yeah,
sixth
sure.
grade. But other than that, you know, I was a healthy kid and it was really weird. So,
and when you say Ohio had pretty strict pre-existing condition laws, you meaning that they protected the insurance companies?
Yeah.
The state did.
Yeah. Ohio was hard. Recently it's come up again that they're you know, obviously with all the stuff going on with health insurance and questions about what's going to be in the future, and I'm actually much more worried about my sister than I am about me. New York's been a fairly protected state in terms of pre-existing condition laws for a while. They have a lot of laws protecting people with pre-existing conditions
from
there.
Being discriminated
exactly,
against.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Dawn, you worked to help actually pass the GINA legislation.
I did.
What were the circumstances that made it necessary?
So, you know, we spent a lot of federal dollars on mapping the human genome, and we had opportunities for patients to undergo genetic testing to learn whether they were at risk and then intervene with medical intervention. And people were not pursuing the testing because they were fearful that their health insurance companies would deny them coverage or deny them from getting the care that they needed. And so in order to reap the benefits of all of the work that many researchers have been doing, we pushed very hard to pass GINA.
How easy would it be to undo GINA at this point?
Well, there haven't been a lot of attempts to try to undo it, but most recently there was one, particularly around health and wellness programs. So GINA allows for individuals and their spouses to voluntarily give genetic information in a health and wellness program by an employer. GINA also covers employment discrimination for genetic information. So there was a recent bill that went forward that was trying to erode some of that protection. That's been stopped at this point, but it's still out there. And so every now and then you have to look to make sure that we're not trying to chip away at the law.
What would be an employer's interest in the genetic information?
So right now, the way GINA stands is it prohibits employers from requiring or requesting an individual to undergo genetic testing, and they can't use genetic information to hire, fire, or reassign someone in a job. But you might imagine an employer might want that information because if they know somebody's at risk, perhaps they won't keep them on and they might let them
go. Because it would go back to the whole insurance issue.
Correct.
Okay. There's another issue about genetic testing for addiction, potential for addiction. Is that really a thing?
Right now, no. Most of it, what your previous guest was talking about is it's dubious genetic testing, and there's really no good clinical evidence to justify doing genetic testing in the cases of opiate addiction or any other type of addiction at this point.
Okay. And another big issue, by the way, listeners, if you have a question or comment, we do have some time. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. We do have some time, and I welcome your questions. There's so many, so many questions. A big issue is how genetic testing affects birth decisions, and Jocelyn Linder, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what your sister did to avoid to avoid the risk of this disease passing on to their children.
Well, my sister and I were really lucky that we our gene was mapped actually when we were in our early 20s. We were told, I was about 25 when it happened, so 2005. and so when they told us that, I think it gave us a little bit of relief because we knew that we had a plan in place. And so the technology that was available at that time was something called, it was basically IVF, so in vitro, with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So PGD is the acronym for that. And basically what happens is you take a 5-day-old a fertilized egg. So it's like a little cluster of cells, and they take one cell and they look at it and they sort of decide whether or not that blastula or that fertilized egg has the condition that you're looking to avoid.
Uh-huh.
And then they implant two healthy ones, or in my sister's case, two healthy ones. And she gave birth to my niece and nephew that are gene free. So it's and there are questions about, ethics behind that. But I actually think that one's about to become, that PGD is about to become the sort of easy one, because there are so many crazy things that are about to start with gene editing that we're
the color kind of eyes and that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, just our ability to change people's existing genome as a living person.
Yeah,
I mean,
existing person.
Yeah, yeah, like there's some really complicated things coming up that I think it's really important we all kind of educate ourselves about the basics of genetics at this point, just because we're about to have some big decisions to make. We're going to be that transitional generation that has to kind of go, what do we want to know, or what can we do? What are we allowed to do? What are our expectations of what we're doing?
Donna, Elaine, how much are you talking about this in the field, the whole ethics of this and what you do with all this incredible information? I remember very clearly when the Human Genome Project, kicked into the high gear about 17 years ago now. It was amazing to think about. And now, just 17 or 20 years later, look where we're at.
Yeah, there's been huge leaps in technology and our ability to know this information. And it's an active conversation all the time within the profession. We have practice guidelines and ethical guidelines. The National Society of Genetic Counselors has a code of ethics that, we adhere to. And so when these complicated decisions come up, we spend time thinking, what's the evidence behind them? How do we help individuals make decisions based on their values and beliefs within that code of ethics?
But I also want to say that, thanks to this technology, my sister had these two healthy kids and other cousins have gotten lucky. And we are right now, our family has 23 kids in the sixth generation, and none of them have our gene. So none of them has our gene. So I feel very.
And so they absolutely can't pass it on either.
Exactly.
It doesn't skip generations or that kind of a thing.
No, not
this one. As far as you know.
Well, it doesn't seem to. It seems to cause everyone some problems.
Yeah. So. Another issue is the red line between health issues and eugenics and using our understandings of genetics now to, affect the outcomes in the cases of the Linder family and then eugenics. What's the difference, Donna Lane?
I think eugenics is a program that's designed to specifically eliminate certain individuals based on characteristics, whereas the use of genetic testing and genetic counseling is designed so that people can make decisions that's best for their families and potentially, stop debilitating diseases.
And then what you were bringing up, it can be a slippery slope, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a really one major question that's come up in the past month is they recently were able to cure mitochondrial deafness in mice. And so the question about deafness, a lot of people in the deaf community would argue that is not a deficit. It's actually an advantage for a lot of people believe that. So we have the major question. Do we cure deafness? Do we cure it in children who can't make the who aren't old enough to say, I don't want this? Do we wait till you're an adult? I mean, and then just generally, is that something we want to cure? So these are, real things that we're at the precipice of having to decide if we want to do them.
And I'm glad you brought up deafness, because that's one of those things a lot of people will say, oh, sure, you want to cure deafness. This isn't about changing from blue eyes to brown eyes. This is something, but it's very nuanced, right?
Right. And disability is different in every individual's
Absolutely.
Eyes. And you can't just make a caveat statement saying, yes, this is an illness, and so we need to take care of it, which is why discussion societally as well as individually is so important.
And what about giving parents the opportunity to change things before the egg is fertilized, for instance?
You know, other than at this point selecting for genetic diseases like, you know, Jocelyn's sister did, we don't have the technology right now to, you know, change the eye color or change mm-hmm. whether or not someone is hearing or not. That will come, I imagine, someday. And those are important questions that we need to be asking in advance of that occurring.
There's another issue. You faced it, sadly, and that's one of abortion. You're pro-choice. But how did that figure into this issue for you, Jocelyn Linder?
Well, we had a, you know, our grandmother in our lifetime, we watched our grandmother lose two sons, and she had passed them this gene, and she didn't know she'd passed them this gene. But my sister and I knew, and we understood, we had a, you know, a very real understanding of what it meant to pass the gene, and that we had this opportunity to stop it felt really important. So, I think, in my case, my husband and I also have to add that I had a lot of health issues at the time. I still do with these vasculopathies, these vascular aneurysms.
That affect your ability to give natural birth,
sure,
right?
And when you're pregnant, your blood supply doubles. I mean, it's, you know, it's not – it isn't a great idea. It wasn't a great idea for me to get pregnant. And there we had an accidental pregnancy, and it was devastating, the whole experience. I was, you know, I think I was really ready to have that baby, and I was trying to get the baby tested, but – Hurricane Sandy came in.
I know. Hurricane Sandy hit and everything was discombobulated.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was prepared to risk it. I think my husband was a little less prepared. But we, in the end, we made the choice to terminate because we were unable to test the embryo to see if it was carrying the gene. So it was very early in the pregnancy.
There are some states that are either considering legislation or have enacted legislation that would limit the ability to turn to abortion in these kinds of cases?
I mean, there is the question of like, you know, I know in England, and I don't know if this is still the case, but there was a law at one point that was like, if you could live a long enough life, so a disease like Huntington's, which is, you know, generally an adult onset, they considered that you couldn't terminate because a person could live into adulthood and have a very productive life. And I don't know what the rules are in the U.S. And I also think, you know, we have very strict, obviously, abortion laws in this country. So there's a point at which you're not. And I imagine if you go beyond that point, we have to decide, you know, if you have a devastating illness that will impact like Tay-Sachs with an infant, do we say like that's okay to sort of end that life? But, you know, obviously that comes under the umbrella of all these complicated questions we have when it comes to abortions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And at this point, you know, in the states, you're right. We have very strict laws around abortion. There's a timeline for when people have to make those decisions. But at this point, there's no – it's not a matter of you can terminate this disease or you can not terminate that disease.
It hasn't come to that.
It hasn't.
They are talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that would ultimately limit some individuals' potential for eliminating the risk of a genetic disorder in future generations.
With your sister, Hillary, when she went the route she did – with adjusting the,
selecting the embryos.
Yeah, yeah. Selecting the embryos. How did they afford that? Was it expensive? Was it something that was easy for a lot of people to do?
I don't think it's cheap.
No. So an individual who's going to undergo PGD will have to do the in vitro fertilization first. So
which is automatically.
Automatically comes with a cost. And depending on how many cycles somebody has to go through, it could be anywhere to $6,000 to $10,000 a cycle. And then the PGD on top of that is anywhere between, you know, $2,000 to $5,000.
As time goes on, are those things supposed to get less expensive?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. One would assume that with time it would. You know, coverage by insurance companies for those techniques
is
a different issue.
Right.
And so not all insurance companies will cover the cost of that technology.
But I always think it's fascinating that in the last 10 years, mapping a genome has gone down from $10,000
exactly.
to 100.
Well, know, or 200 know. Bucks, you know,
right.
we were talking about earlier.
Yes.
It's amazing. It's coming on very, very fast. Thank you so much for joining us today to help shed some light on this issue.
Thank you so much for having me. me.
That's Jocelyn Linder. Her new book is entitled The Family Gene, A Mission to Turn My Deadly Inheritance into a Hopeful Future. Also, Donna Lane, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Donna Lane is a licensed genetic counselor at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, our All Sides interns, Sarah Stacey and Kyle McKinnon, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.